This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Muammar Gaddafi is paying Libyans to say they support him. It's not really working. The president says he's open to compromise on health care, and Bill Gates says we have to be smarter about education. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. And by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, today, the last day of February. Good, as always, to have you with us. Here's an interesting economic fact about Libya and Muammar Gaddafi and where a lot of that country's oil money has gone. The Treasury Department announced today it has frozen at least $30 billion in Libyan assets. $30 billion. The entire Libyan economy? About $90 billion or so. Treasury Department didn't give any details as to how much was in Gaddafi's name personally and how much of that money was in Libya's sovereign wealth fund. But either way you figure it, it's about a third of the entire Libyan economy. As of right now, the only real pressure that Western governments can bring to bear on Gaddafi is economic, and we'll get more on that in just a minute. First, though, we've reached New York Times correspondent David Kirkpatrick. He's in Tripoli. David, good to speak with you.
Good to be here.
First of all, what's it like out there day to day? Are people out and about, or are the streets, as you wrote in the paper today, still pretty much empty?
The streets are pretty deserted. Out of the highways, they're crowded. They're crowded because people are leaving. People by the thousands are trying to make their way to the border with Tunisia, which is not so far from Tripoli. You've called, actually, at a pretty newsy moment. We've just learned that the government of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi is reporting 10 casualties in a battle with the rebels at a city about 30 miles from here called Zawiya. They've got a number of defecting army forces ringing their perimeter, about 2,000 defecting police officers with their guns. And when we saw them yesterday, they were sort of celebrating and dancing and looking kind of warily at the Gaddafi forces building up on the outside.
All these people are leaving, and one assumes in Zawiya as well they will soon be leaving if the army's on the move. They are effectively refugees, taking with them what they have.
Yeah, they are. Now, the people who get through the border are foreign workers because the Libyans don't seem to let the Libyans out and the Tunisians don't seem to let the Libyans in. But there are a lot of foreign workers here, a lot of Chinese folks working in the oil fields as well as Egyptians and a few Tunisians, all of whom are now getting out as fast as they can because the climate has turned ugly for foreigners. There's a kind of xenophobia that's kicked in.
What do you know about the oil industry there? Is it under the control of the anti-Gaddafi forces, or does the government still have some control?
The anti-Gaddafi forces report that they have control over 80% of it or so, which seems reasonable given where their footprint is, including Zawiya. However, that's one of the places where the Gaddafi forces appear to be making a concerted assault tonight. That's obviously where it's at here. I mean, it's oil is the lifeblood of the economy. Whoever controls the oil resources is in a commanding position to decide the future of the country.
And from the people, the ones that you've been able to talk to, and I gather your movements are a little bit restricted, the ones who are getting the $400 from the government to basically be friendly, what are they saying to you, the people?
They say, you know, I'll tell you an interesting experience I had today. I was out in a town where we were surrounded by quite boisterous, if not aggressive, pro-Gaddafi revelers who really seemed extremely motivated to get in our face and tell us just how much they loved Gaddafi and kissing his picture and so forth. And I let one of these gentlemen go on and deliver his whole rant, which was part one, Gaddafi's great, part two, the problem here is Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and the Arabic cable channels. And he finished his rant, and by that time, the crowd had drifted away, and it was just the two of us. And I leaned in and I said to him, you know, they've been killing a lot of people in the nearby cities, and I think actually they're paying you to say this. And he said, yes. Hmm. And believe me, sir, we will get our freedom. So here, there he was, talking out of both sides of his mouth. Several other people came and said the same thing to me. So there's, you know, kind of an undercurrent even in the pro-Gaddafi crowd.
David Kirkpatrick with the New York Times from Tripoli. David, thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure to be here. Talk to you later.
The European Union jumped on the Libyan sanctions bandwagon today. The EU joined the United States, the UN, and Canada, all of whom have imposed similar measures the past couple of days. The sanctions aren't what you would call wide-ranging. They're more targeted, aimed directly at Muammar Gaddafi and those close to him. As with all sanctions, though, the question is, are they going to do anything? From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
The sanctions will freeze Libyan assets. Just in the case of the U.S., we're talking at least $30 billion worth. There are visa bans in place for Gaddafi, his family, and his inner circle, and there's an embargo on selling arms to Libya. Victor Comrade spent decades working on sanctions programs at the State Department. He thinks they'll be effective. It used to be lucrative to be tight with Gaddafi, but now anybody who works with the Libyan leader could find himself in big trouble, even accused of collaborating on war crimes.
He might find himself before the International Criminal Court. So I think that the signal is very strong to those that are closely associated with Mr. Gaddafi that this is a time to abandon ship.
Still, Gaddafi was presumably clever enough not to keep all of his assets in Western countries or in accounts under his own name, so it could take a while for him to be completely cut off. Brian Early is a political science professor at SUNY Albany. He's concerned the sanctions could backfire.
It might put more pressure on the leadership to stay in power because they know they have very little alternatives if they choose to step down.
He says the sanctions do send a powerful message of disapproval from the West, but if the past is any indication, Gaddafi doesn't seem to mind being an international pariah. The international community could still take things a few steps further. Germany's proposing a broader economic embargo, which would block oil payments for 60 days. And there's talk of imposing a no-fly zone over the eastern part of the country to limit airstrikes against protesters. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Oil traders took the day's news in stride. Crude fell a buck or so in New York, just a hair under $97 a barrel at the close. Stocks were mostly higher. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are just now, believe it or not, getting down to brass tacks on health care reform. That year or so debate we had, that was about the politics of it. Now Washington is writing the actual rules for how health care reform is going to happen. In that vein, President Obama had a session with the state governors today. They're in Washington for their annual meeting. And they were a relatively hostile audience. About half the states are challenging health care reform in court. So today the president said, yeah, I can be flexible. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The health reform law lets states come up with their own ways to expand affordable insurance coverage, but not until 2017. Before then, all states have to stick with the federal guidelines. Today, President Obama endorsed a Senate bill to let states design their own reforms 3 years earlier.
If your state can create a plan that covers as many people as affordably and comprehensively as the Affordable Care Act does, without increasing the deficit, you can implement that plan. And we'll work with you to do it.
For instance, White House officials point to an idea from the governor of Indiana. He's considering using the new reform law's private insurance exchanges to cover Medicaid recipients. Les Funtleiter is healthcare portfolio manager for Miller Tabak. He says states will want to tailor their healthcare systems depending on how old or rural or educated the population is.
The one-size-fits-all approach was never going to work in the first place.
But could White House flexibility allow states that are hostile to reforms chip away at them? The co-sponsor of the Senate bill, Louisiana Democrat Mary Landrieu, says that won't happen.
The states have to reach the same goals. For instance, coverage must be provided for every adult. If some states think that they can meet these goals in a different, more cost-effective way, then I think that's what we all need to be talking about.
White House officials say they don't want to open up the health reform law to any other changes. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We learned this morning consumers had more money in their pockets in January. Personal income rose the most it has in 2 years, thanks to the Social Security tax cut that was passed in December. And that, the reasonable economic play goes, means we'll be spending more, too. Blackstone, the private equity group, will be spending $9.5 billion to buy the U.S. properties of a deeply indebted Australian company called Centro. To you and me, that means about 600 strip malls housing stores like Kroger and Walmart and Sears. Whether or not we're actually going to see fewer empty storefronts now that we've got more money? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has that story.
Strip malls, those long lines of stores on the side of the road, have a reputation for being kind of depressing. But today, they may represent some optimism about the buying power of the American consumer. George Krasulik is a real estate partner with law firm Duane Morris. He says the Blackstone deal today shows that prices for stores and office buildings, or commercial real estate, are rebounding. Buyers want to get in while there are still good deals.
Yes, it's probably for what you would classify as a distressed situation, but it's still good given where we've been.
People familiar with Blackstone say the firm believes Americans will start shopping again, and at the price it paid, Blackstone can wait. Centro bought the shopping centers at the height of the real estate bubble and has been trying to sell them for over 2 years. The recession emptied out many storefronts starting in 2008. Landlords like Centro extended their loans as far as 2014 and pretended they would get the rents to pay them off to avoid bankruptcy.
We all made fun of the phrase extend and pretend, but it's kind of working.
George Ratu, an economist with the National Association of Realtors, says it was just a matter of waiting for the economy to rebound. Now, he says, things are going to get better.
I would say commercial real estate is stabilizing, and if anything, the prospects for 2011 look fairly promising.
Of course, a lot of those extended loans on stores and offices come due around 2014. Let's check back then. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
You do this job long enough, you get a sense for what's going to be news on any given day. All right, so it's not just me who can do that. They put out calendars of the big economic announcements. On Friday, it's going to be all jobs all the time. We will be treated to the February unemployment report, how many jobs the economy added or not. And so far, as we all know, businesses have been slow to hire. Commentator David Leonhardt says when they eventually do hire, businesses would do well to remember one important demographic.
There's a whole group of workers out there who could give your business an immediate boost. They're called moms. Not all moms, of course, but a lot of them. The fact is, the modern workplace still does not recognize the realities of family life, and the burdens of it still fall mostly on women. Many more women take time off or work part-time. Many more can't get to work early or stay late. And doing any of these things tends to bring a terrible career penalty. Here's a quiz. How many kids did the last three female Supreme Court nominees have combined? Zero. How many kids combined did the last three male nominees have? Seven. That isn't a coincidence. The good news is that there's been a big decline in blatant sexism. Women and men with similar resumes now earn nearly the same amount. But when you look at all women and men, women still earn much, much less. Why? Take a look at the University of Chicago's business school graduates from the 1990s. Right after graduation, the women and men had nearly identical incomes. But 15 years later, men were making a whopping 75% more. And these patterns aren't true only for MBAs. At Walmart, the store managers are overwhelmingly male. Now think about what this means. A huge group of women are underemployed. To put it bluntly, many are more talented than the men they work for. They've stepped off the career fast track and have never been able to get back on. A few professions, like some branches of medicine, are smartly making it much easier to work part-time. Assuming you're not in one of those professions, your company has a chance to gain an edge. Create some good new career paths, and a whole new talent pool becomes available. Call me an optimist, but I bet you get some talented dads coming to work for you, too.
David Leonhardt writes the Economic Scene column for the New York Times. We would love for you to write to us. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, 5 years ago, Arizona's budget was $1 billion to the good from property tax revenues. And they were thinking,
we could build houses forever and ever and ever and ever.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 95 points today, about 0.75%, ended things at 12,226. The NASDAQ remained just about where it began, putting on just a point less than 0.1%, ended the day at 2782. The S&P 500 added 7 points. 0.5% finished at 1327. For the month, and yes, it is over already, the Dow rose 2.8%, the NASDAQ up 3%, the S&P 500 shot up 3.2%. We told you earlier about big commercial real estate deals. Senior housing was in demand today. Ventas, the biggest player in the senior market, said it would buy Nationwide Health properties for nearly $6 billion. NHP shares built up nearly 10%. Ventas got nailed. Amazon dragged down the NASDAQ. Its shares shed 2.25% today after one big investment house dropped its rating on the stock. Bonds held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.42%. And thanks for asking. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. By Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday, March 1st. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for January. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testifies before the House Foreign Affairs Committee during a hearing to assess U.S. foreign policy priorities amidst economic challenges. And March is National Women's History Month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's been a busy day for the nation's governors. Not only did they have that session with the president this morning about their budget problems and what to do about the health care law, they had to sit through a session on education policy as well and what to do about public education when there is not enough money to go around. The guy giving the speech runs an outfit that does have money to go around. In fact, that's why the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation exists. Bill Gates says he's speaking out now because education is the key issue facing this country. Bill Gates, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So think about this for me as the businessman that you work for so long, instead of a guy running a really big foundation, and answer this question. For all the billions of dollars that we have spent fixing our schools for the past 20 or 30 years, what have we actually bought? What have we gotten?
Well, our achievement has been pretty flat while other countries have managed to improve their achievement. And so now what we're going to have to do is get better performance. Now, fortunately, there's two things I think that can help us achieve that. One is by looking at what the great teachers do and transferring those skills. And the second is using some technology to help students who fall behind get some personalized learning. That's a new capability that works in our favor.
Well, let me pick up on that technology comment of yours. You have been talking for a long time, a generation probably now or more, about the prospect of technology as a positive force for change. And yet education, by most measures, seems to be resistant to that. Tell me how we get education to adapt technology, not just in the classroom, but systemically.
Well, you have to have a willingness to do pilot programs. The question of when you have a kid who's behind in math, identifying exactly what they're missing and drilling in on that. We haven't incorporated that into the education system. And yet I think a lot of the charter schools are doing that. Some high schools are working with people like Saul Kahn to see how they can mix classroom learning and online learning and get the best of both of those things.
I was struck by one of the things in your speech today about class size. You seem not to be a fan of spending a lot of money to get fewer kids in a classroom, which I suppose from a financial standpoint makes a lot of sense. But how do you defend that point to a parent with a fourth grader in a class full of 35 or 40 kids?
Well, no one's talking about running the class sizes up to 40 or anything like that. But the investment that counts the most is making sure you have a great teacher. If we didn't have these budget constraints, then it'd be great to invest in both effective teaching and continuing to reduce class size. But now that we have the challenges, our point is that you really ought to deal with the variable that matters the most. And if you ask teachers for a little additional pay, would you be willing to teach a somewhat larger class size? They say yes. And if you do that with the effective teachers, then everyone is better off.
You realize, though, that there are districts in this country, many of them, with 35 or 40 kids in a class.
Yeah, and once you get up into those ranges, then you're not investing enough in education. And what we're being asked is, as people are having tough trade-offs, what is the highest priority? And helping teachers be more effective, we'd put at the top of the list.
Okay, so how do you get better and more effective teachers? Because that was a large part of your speech today. You have talked before about tracking the best teacher genome. I mean, how do you make this happen?
Today, teachers are given almost no feedback. The amount of time that goes into helping to evaluate them, tell them areas they should improve in, is just very different than most professions. And so we're engaged in pilot projects with a number of districts around the country where the teachers, the teachers' union, the superintendents are all involved in running a personnel system that identifies these amazing teachers and helps them spread what they do to the other teachers.
Bill Gates, he's the co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which, we ought to say, financially supports some of the education reporting you hear on this broadcast. Mr. Gates, thanks very much.
Thank you.
If you want to check out the presentation that Bill Gates made to the nation's governors today, we've got it. It's at our website, marketplace.org. Even though most of the attention is focused on Wisconsin and the political fight there over collective bargaining rights and budget deficits, it's not like most other states don't have big financial problems themselves. We're long past the point of asking how all the red ink came to be, mostly because we all think we know the answer, the housing bust and the recession. And that's true, as far as it goes. But state government gets part of the blame, too. From KJZZ in Phoenix, Peter O'Dowd reports.
For 30 years, Alan McGuire counseled state lawmakers and governors on economic policy. Today, he stands atop the windy peak of South Mountain, 2,300 feet above the desert floor. From here, Phoenix spreads out in all directions.
I would say that from here, we can probably see 50,000 rooftops.
It's Arizona epitomized. Half a decade ago, Phoenix had boomed into one of the fastest-growing cities in the country, and tax revenue from all these new homes and service jobs put Arizona's budget more than $1 billion into the black. McGuire says thinking at the state capitol went like this.
We could build houses forever and ever and ever and ever.
So the state started spending, like rich states often do, spending on jails and health care, spending on social services like a now-defunct program called All Day Kindergarten. It had an annual price tag of more than $200 million. McGuire says the problem was these tax riches were temporary, but penciled into the budget as permanent revenue.
And so then, a few years later, when the housing bubble burst and the housing construction stopped, those one-time revenues stopped, but the long-term ongoing obligations remained.
It's a good example of how to get in trouble. Unfortunately, Arizona's not alone. A lot of states did that.
John Schur is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. He says the recession is the biggest culprit for state budget problems across the country. But legislators do shoulder some of the blame.
State policymakers sometimes forget to realize that the economy goes up and down. When you're at the bottom of a deep hole, you need a ladder to climb out.
Economists say Arizona's ladder is missing a few rungs. Dana Namark stands outside the gates of Xavier College Preparatory on a recent afternoon.
This setting represents one of the choices we made over the years that has dug our hole deeper.
Namark was once a legislative budget analyst. She says in 2009, Arizona dished out about $50 million in tax credits to people who donated to tuition scholarship funds for private schools like this one. It's just one tax break on top of many others.
Individual income tax, corporate income tax, business property taxes, tax credits for solar energy.
A study out this year shows that Arizona implemented tax cuts every year between 1993 and 2002 and started again in 2005. It's cost the state almost $3 billion.
It's not that all the tax cuts are wrong or bad ideas. Some of them are good ideas. But the problem is we do it repeatedly without thinking about the impact on the other side of the ledger.
And it's people like Heba Tawfig who live on the other side of that ledger.
What is Jano?
Today, the single mother of two is helping care for a friend's sick child. Tawfik is a Sudanese refugee. She explains how difficult it's been to find child care for her own daughters. Cuts have forced the state to drop about 20,000 children from a daycare subsidy program, a program she needed when the children's grandmother left the country.
I went to apply for child care. They informed me that the waiting list is 2 years.
With no help from her family or the state, Tawfig says she was forced to leave her 6- and 8-year-olds at home alone while she went to her job as a social worker. The worry was too much, so she quit, and now she lives on $600 a month in child support from her ex-husband. She's had time to ponder the consequences of the state's budget crisis.
It's a big effect on people, and I believe they are not doing the right decision.
Arizona lawmakers are weighing further cuts to social programs as they try to close a $700 million budget gap. The struggle is one of many difficult debates playing out in state houses across the country. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the first and last comment you will hear on this broadcast about last night's Academy Awards. Somebody here in the office called me old today just because I thought James Franco did a lousy job last night. First of all, ouch. Second of all, I'm right. The numbers don't lie. Nielsen reported preliminary figures for the telecast today. Overall down 7% from a year ago. That younger, hipper demographic the Academy was going for, 2% fewer of them as well. So call me old. Fine. You kids, get off my lawn. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media, APM. Today, the Dow picked up 95 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ put on just a point less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 added 7 points, about 0.5%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here in Jakarta, Indonesia, some roads force you to carpool. So what if nobody's going your way? Enter the carpool jockey.
They're really the real businessmen because they can do income from the critical situation.
Critical situation like not having a ride to work. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.